Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up today, of course, we'll talk about Amazon. We'll also talk about the U.S. toy retail industry, and we'll discuss paint, as in Sherwin-Williams. They released earnings this week as well. If you can, please take a quick second to rate us or like and subscribe. However you access the Retail Focus, would be greatly appreciated. Your ratings improve our visibility, but mostly we just want to hear from you. And again, we're now back on YouTube, where you can subscribe to our channel under the name Retail Focus Podcast. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter or the Insta at Retail Podcast. Also, as you may have noticed, we have a hole for a sponsorship. So if you're a sponsor out there, if you'd like to market to a podcast with over 20,000 listeners per week, please let us know. retailpodcast@gmail.com. So we begin with the toy industry. Now, Mattel has been hurting thanks to the dramatic fall of Toys R Us, but it was Hasbro making its way into our newsfeed following a disappointing fiscal first quarter earlier this week. Hasbro reported on Monday before the sound of the opening bell on Wall Street. And according to the company's website, to give you a little background, Hasbro exists as a global play and entertainment company committed to creating the world's best play experiences. Now, that's from their website. In reality, they've been struggling a little bit. And for their quarterly figures, we have to consider the company had one less operating week in this year's first quarter versus 2017's. But even accounting for that, these financial figures were nothing if not terrible, as the company blamed several one-time events for some horrid comparisons, and shares immediately after the earnings call were down 9% in after-hours trading Monday, ended up rebounding later in the week, but still not good news from Hasbro overall as they showed a loss.
I think the question you have to ask yourself if you're an investor of either of these two major companies you had mentioned, Mattel, but also Hasbro, is where do they plan on funneling all of their toys and entertainment items down the line? Because obviously Toys R Us no longer going to exist, and that's something that they were counting on in previous years to funnel a lot of their inventory towards. But without those major industry players, you have to wonder, where is their business going to go moving forward? Obviously, they're focused more on e-commerce, as we'll go into the details there in the earnings call, but in general, you're seeing a lot less toys being presented in the brick and mortar space. So a lot of questions that have to be asked if you're part of the management team here at Hasbro. We see that Hasbro ticked in a net loss this quarter of $112.5 million, or roughly 90 cents per diluted share. And this includes several after-tax expenses of around $61.4 million associated with, yes, Toys R Us, and other severance costs associated with an acceleration of what they said was the company's ongoing commercial organization transformation. So the company is undergoing some major management restructuring, some restructuring that has been needed for quite some time. And then also additionally, a third net charge of $47.8 million related to the U.S. tax reform. All three expenses were listed under one-time events, therefore giving the company positive adjusted net income of around $12.4 million, or around 10 cents per diluted share. This missed even those adjusted expectations from analysts by 23 cents per share. The company had a profit of roughly $68.6 million, or 54 cents per share, this time last year. So that puts it in perspective. The company is hurting regardless of those one-time expenses or the one-time happenings from this latest quarter or this last fiscal year. Revenue in the first quarter fell over 15% year over year to $716.3 million. Analysts were expecting a big decline, but not this big. Experts on a consensus basis were looking towards forecasts of around $814 million in top-line revenue. CEO Brian Goldner said that the Hasbro teams executed extremely well during a challenging first quarter. He went on to say that Hasbro brands are resonating with customers and a consumer base. Takeaway is generally positive. However, as we discussed earlier in the year, he said our first quarter was expected to be difficult. So by saying such things, he was telling those listening in on the conference call that the company had forewarned people, especially investors, of a poor result come the day of this earnings disclosure. On top of other retailers cutting back on orders, either because of downsizing or going out of business entirely, Hasbro has been faced with trying to market their more popular items in a different way. Goldner pointed out that this is not just where people are buying play and entertainment items, but how? The integration of mobile has been an obvious advantage that is perhaps tougher to overcome for a toy company or a toy manufacturer than a, let's say, home furnishings company, especially considering how many toys now come in the form of phone games, even for the youngest of kids. Despite all of this, they are confident in their overall exposure throughout the United States, even if this is on the back of lower total sales figures. Management claims to have a presence in more than 21,000 more retailers over the last few years. They are basically saying that while the online channels are growing, they have sustained robust growth still in brick and mortar, despite all of the different retailers that have gone or are going out of business in the present day. They've actually made it easier from a variety store perspective to work with them on a wholesale basis. Let's be mindful that Hasbro is also in smaller size general merchandise retailers like Dollar General, which has seen steady yearly growth in total number of locations while not providing the sales per location that Toys R Us once did for them. To put this in perspective, Dollar General opened about 1,200 stores in 2017, and Toys R Us, even with their mass closures, is shuttering only about 800. Same could be said for Walmart as well. They are calling this near-term disruption, not really seeing current individual woes part of a larger existential crisis. Deborah Thomas, the Hasbro's chief financial officer, noted that their underlying financials are very sound. If you look at the balance sheet, they are, in fact, still sound with a lot of cash on the balance sheet, despite issues in the near term, particularly this quarter. They hope that their strong position will allow them to endure a negative 2018 before growth in 2019 and beyond. And they said this in a statement. She also mentioned that the events leading towards lower revenues and higher expenses weren't reflective of their overall business. And we must take this with a grain of salt, as major toy store closures definitely speak to their ability to market long term. This didn't relieve too many skeptics, however, Trent, as people were calling into question the facts of having a retailer liquidate in Toys R Us that many of us saw as having 15% or even more of the toy industry's retail market share.
They can talk all they want about how many more retailer doors they're in, but the reality of it is when you have a closure of a big box toy retailer like Toys R Us, that's going to be more impactful than getting into more smaller locations that are generally selling lower priced goods. And in a previous episode, we actually highlighted some of the brick and mortar and online retailers that could perhaps take advantage in terms of toy market share of the Toys R Us collapse. Despite that, you can't help but wonder the effects over the next 5 years as other retailers begin to meet the current levels of toy demand. And any economist out there would tell you that there's going to be a lag in correction for any industry if there's a supply and demand shock. Here you have a supply shock with Toys R Us locations closing. And even though Toys R Us did declare bankruptcy, they were still bringing in money. They were still bringing in sales. The sales numbers weren't where they expected them to be, but it's still a large chunk, again, 15% of the U.S. market share. Shocks like that take time to play out. The consumer isn't perfect, nor are the retailers looking to get a piece of the toy pie, so there's going to be some maneuvering around here. And going forward, Hasbro has got to be reliant on marketing efforts and product innovation. And they say that their product innovation has actually already spurred higher demand for Hasbro gaming products and items under their partner brands umbrella. And they're confident in their retailing partners, which include a number of general merchandise retailers, about their ability to soak up the void left by Toys R Us. From Hasbro's vantage point, the Toys R Us liquidation didn't happen to them, so they're staying focused on simply what they have as a disposal to spur sales, particularly in online and direct-to-consumer channels. That's an area that they've already experienced apparent gains. So this is a case of the manufacturer becoming very much the retailer and going direct to the consumer in this regard. I understand their vantage point, and they said this time and again on the earnings call. If you were on the earnings call, they referenced multiple times about how, well, the bankruptcy didn't happen to us. And again, we're in solid financial footing. But the fact remains that 15% of the market share of U.S. toy stores was eliminated basically overnight. That includes orders that that company was placing. So you've got to answer for that as a company. And I don't know that investors, first of all, were too happy about the answers that Hasbro had on the earnings call. And I don't know that I was too satisfied with the answers that they had on the earnings call about where they're distributing their products, other than the direct-to-consumer channels, which I think is certainly a good method for them. I don't know that Hasbro has quite like the name recognition that Mattel does in the United States, but it is certainly an avenue through which they can drum up some of those direct-to-consumer sales and hope to make some of that market share back. Now, as far as the licensed toys and brands they're excited about for this coming fiscal year, they include Transformers, Quickstrike, Magic the Gathering, which, yes, is still around and still driving sales, and, of course, the big Marvel movie Black Panther, one of the largest movies of our lifetime and certainly the largest in terms of the box office haul. They also anticipate a continuation of strong Star Wars sales ahead of the franchise's new movie. And that new movie, by the way, looking to debut May 25th.
As far as the guidance is concerned, the company is reiterating much of what they believe is going to be modest sales gains in certain areas for the rest of 2018. As Trent mentioned, they're going to have some strength with certain brands and certain bold names, like the Black Panther, for instance, is going to drive a lot of new toys and entertainment items for Hasbro. And they're able to really license and leverage that strong relationship that they have with these companies, with these main brands, to really drum up sales for the continuation of 2018. And while management seems unsure about the next few years, they believe that the predominant growth driver will be getting access in developing international markets. So sort of straying away from the United States here, at least in the short to midterm, but keeping the same strategy in terms of how they will be capturing these swaths of certain land. Certainly, up-and-coming markets will need product innovation and bold marketing tactics, both of which they've said have really made them successful in the short term here in the United States here recently, particularly product innovation, taking these strong brands, taking these strong names that people are familiar with, and creating toys and elements of entertainment that will live a lasting legacy. So kids are going to be growing up with these items, and they certainly want to have that resonate with these families. Shares of the behemoth toy manufacturer and retailer, like we said, were down in after-hours trading, but ended up back up to where they left off before Monday. On Wednesday, shares were up another 0.5%, but still far below the one-year-ago levels, trading around $86 a share right now as of recording this podcast. This versus all-time highs in July of 2017 of around $116 a share. While down significantly for the year, they really have only given back gains acquired over the last 15 months or so. So per usual, we have to give the stock levels or the share price a little bit of context as to where they have an opportunity to grow in the future or where they've been in the recent past. And for now, Trent, if I were a shareholder or a prospective shareholder, I would sort of hold off and see if their strategy as far as the international growth is concerned and the continued licensing really pans out for the rest of the year. Well, everybody at some point or another is going to need a fresh coat of paint, but that sentiment didn't aid the shares of Sherwin-Williams as their stock hit a six-month low on Tuesday after first quarter earnings. Sherwin-Williams has been a company that has done very well in the last couple of years, pleasing investors with international growth and acquisitions that are said to grow their retail presence and increase their relative brand equity. They hold a lot of different brands, as we'll be talking about, but Sherwin-Williams is a powerhouse in the paint industry. For a company that trades around 30 times earnings right now, you would expect strong numbers on a consistent basis. However, because of their earnings multiple on the back of a mature company, or at least their mature stance in a given industry, it sometimes doesn't take too much for the shares to take a step back, even if they're largely hitting their quarterly marks. And that was the case this quarter. They hit their marks and more, certainly in the profit realm, as profit rose to $250.1 million or $2.62 a share from $239 million or around $2.53 a share a year earlier. On an adjusted basis, taking out some of their recent acquisition costs with Valspar, as we'll get into a little more in depth, they reported an earnings per share level of around $3.50 per share. On a side note, we believe that while acquisitions are usually a one-time cost, they should be viewed as normal business occurrence in the face of a larger strategic vision. And that larger strategic vision, at least for Sherwin-Williams, is to basically grow as fast as possible given their mature stance in the paint industry. And I think, obviously, we had really applauded the Valspar acquisition in previous podcasts and had really looked towards Sherwin-Williams as more of a bellwether in the home improvement space. So what we're just trying to say here is that this is a normal business occurrence, but they are able to amortize, if you will, the expense of this acquisition through the following quarters. And so they are operating in an extremely efficient level still, despite all of that. In terms of selling, general, and administrative expenses, they increased, however, to $203.5 million or 20.1% of revenue, to around $1.2 billion in their first quarter, but decreased as a percent of sales to around 30.6% from 36.6% in the same quarter last year. So selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percent of revenue is falling, despite the absolute number going up, because they obviously have a bigger business to attend to. They are finding those all-important synergies from the inclusion of those Valspar operations. So despite maybe some job losses, they are operating at a more efficient pace and looking to really take out any additional value from that inclusion. And speaking of timely acquisitions, Valspar looks to already be paying dividends, Trent, as it helped the company's top line climb 44% year over year.
That revenue boost helped the company to beat Wall Street analyst expectations by half a percentage point as they brought in $3.97 billion. Now, the downside of this before and the earnings call, before we get to some relevant business details and, of course, the retail insight, which is why you guys are here to hear about Sherwin-Williams' retail influence, forward guidance was lowered to $14.95 to $15.45 in terms of earnings per share. That was down about 40 cents from a prior estimate of $15.35 per share to $15.85 per share. Now, to put this in perspective, last quarter they reported full year earnings per share over $18, and Valspar acquisitions costs are still being taken into account. For the record, higher interest expense is a main factor in the reduced earnings per share numbers going forward. And before we go any farther, full disclosure, I am a Sherwin-Williams shareholder. They're a company that we've talked about before on the podcast, and actually a rare company that we recommended potentially becoming a shareholder on the podcast, although we don't do that very often. And I know from a shareholder's perspective, you look at this number and you think, they might be sandbagging here, and you see this from a few firms every now and again, but I think they're just trying to temper expectations going forward on just how much this Valspar acquisition is going to help their bottom line. We know it's helping their top line, but how much it's going to help their bottom line. Now, as far as some important company highlights on this earnings call and the highlights that came up in the investor Q&A, the company has three main operating segments. They have the Americas Group, which is the one that we're most familiar with from the retail side, Performance Coatings, and the Consumer Brands Group. And the Americas Group is actually a joining of two legacy segments, the Paint Stores Division and the Latin Coatings Division. Sales for the Americas Group in the first quarter increased $128.7 million. That's 6.6% to $2.08 billion. And a lot of that is from retail. And here's where we dive into the retail numbers. Comparable store sales for their Americas Group, which includes U.S., Canada, and their Caribbean division, increased 5.2% over last year in the first quarter. Keep in mind, they had a fantastic year in those retail stores last year, and they were very close to making our list of the top five retailers of 2017. Now, Canadian comps were said to beat those brought forth in the U.S., which were mostly up if you separate by geographical division. Operating margin on the retail side for North America increased 60 basis points to 16.2% from 15.6% last year, which again speaks to that SG&A efficiency that Leighton talked about earlier. Within the Americas Group segment, they do include sales from commercial property and property management companies as well. And again, so they are larger distributors throughout the United States of paint. It's not all just from the retail stores, or sometimes the retail stores will have contracts from the commercial property and property management companies. Management described what they saw as a slow to take off painting season for the beginning of the year. But Leighton, we must also remember that the temperature was down throughout most of the country at the beginning of the year, and exterior paint, a lot of people often put that off until the warmer months. So it's one of the reasons why painting season may have been just a little bit slower than what they wanted to see, despite beating on a lot of the analyst estimates. And Leighton, residential paint sales also included in the Americas Group segment. While they didn't speak too much on direct initiatives with marketing, they did say they want to be perceived as a value proposition, not only just as a good paint, but a value proposition too, and that there was and is still a push to get pricing down to promotional levels.
Even still, they were able to extract recent total sales gains from both volume and pricing. Growth between these two factors was split around 50-50. So Obviously, the growth is going to be split with volume and pricing here, but you have to look at the statements that Trent just made to really get a big picture view of what the company is doing. They want to have that value proposition on some of their products. They want promotional pricing to really drive the volume, but they're actually being able, at least for this latest quarter, to extract both gains, actually extract the gains in pricing on certain items and the volume in general from the residential paint sales. So I think this is a win-win for the company. If you're able to have as many brands as Sherwin-Williams does, some of the brands can take on that promotional pricing to spur up growth in certain categories, while the other well-known brands that have a robust image behind them, they can actually keep a price point that is a little more elastic with the customer. Sales to residential repaint contractors in the United States and Canada grew at a double-digit pace for the 16th time in 18 quarters. This, according to the statements in the conference call, protective and marine coating sales in the U.S. and Canada also grew in the high single-digit range. An increase in sales to new home builders and people pursuing do-it-yourself projects were said to be a function of this good news. These numbers make sense as new home sales have been fairly strong in the recent past, despite larger market constraints like the cost of lumber, let's say, and land in certain areas of the United States. According to Redfin, in fact, new construction homes in the fourth quarter of 2017 accounted for 16.4% of all single-family homes that have been sold, the highest level since Redfin began tracking this data in 2012. For do-it-yourself projects, we don't have the numbers to go off of like we did with the Redfin statistic, but we are seeing that incomes are rising for individuals and retirements are also on the rise as more baby boomers are choosing to retire early, or it is that time to put off the work and start these home projects. And overall, you're seeing that more people are more likely to be going out and spending some money to take care of home projects that have maybe been put off over the last few months or the last few years. As for the Consumer Brands Group, which is going to be the second and last division we talk about here with Sherwin-Williams, this includes sales from popular brands like Valspar, Thompson Water Seal, Dutch Boy, and Purdy. And these are going to be sales that aren't strictly at their retail stores. So all of the sales that they're getting from this particular sector are towards the major retailers and contractors that are interested in these brands. They saw external net sales increase by $333 million or 103% to $656.4 million in total. Segment profit for the Consumer Brands Group in the first quarter increased $18.3 million or roughly 32% to $74.2 million. Without the inclusion of Valspar, segment profit actually would have dropped. This means that Valspar is a profitable segment already. So not only are they getting some cost efficiencies borne out through this acquisition, they're seeing that it's already very profitable for their overall bottom line, something Trent had alluded to and something we have to keep an eye on for the quarters to come to see if the Valspar acquisition really truly does pay off in terms of the multiple that they paid. Valspar is pretty clearly a net positive for the company thus far, but it will take some time to get everything ironed out with the cost of the acquisition, like I talked about, and the different expense accounts that they had mentioned during the earnings call associated with previous contracts. By that, I mean some of these larger contracts were actually financed in-house, if you will. Therefore, they're taking on some cost of that burden in terms of debt. So with all of that in mind, the company fared pretty well, but Trent, shares didn't reflect that again.
The shares fell close to 5% after news of the tepid full-year guidance. I think Wall Street was pretty happy with everything else from this earnings call. The stock did rebound a bit temporarily, but is back down to where it cratered on Tuesday to about $3.68 per share. Now, the share is back up into the 370s as we near the end of the week. All-time highs of over $425 per share were achieved back in January, but it'll probably take a strong second and third quarter to bring back this type of market valuation. Even though the company continues to execute on its growth, certainly as the demand to help fulfill its potential long term, they're still trading even today at a multiple of 20. So it's unlikely you're going to see that share price increase too much more. Now, coming up, we'll talk about Amazon, still yet to come, as we're waiting on more details from their earnings call as we record this on Thursday afternoon. And we'll talk rent to own. That's all when we return after the music. Well, Amazon reported after the closing bell on Thursday, and that's, again, when we're recording the podcast, so we've been trying to cobble details and listen to parts of the earnings call coming out, as Amazon was coming up against diverse expectations. Some were worrying about government uncertainty and increased reinvestment. Others were worried that maybe the margin wouldn't be where it should. Pre-trading bulls came out today for Amazon as the stock spiked around 4% in pre-call trading on Thursday. As it turns out, those bulls were correct, more or less. The consensus still had Amazon surging in retail sales and overall revenue, and that includes their ever-growing Amazon Web Services platform. With worries of reinvestment and growing AWS costs, analysts estimated Amazon's first quarter profit to be around $1.26 per share, down from the $1.48 per share reported last year. Now, revenue is expected to be nearly $50 billion going into the call. Those consensus estimates come by way of Thomson Reuters. Amazon, like other usually positive headline-making retailers, is trading rather high. In fact, multiples up over 200. And that may mean, like with Sherwin-Williams, there's increased volatility with their long-term prospects. With Sherwin-Williams, it was their full-year earnings per share, but Amazon's seeing pressure from a number of avenues coming into this earnings call. They were seeing pressure from political avenues, what can be considered competition from established retailers, some niche retailers as well, and costs associated with the server farms that they have for AWS and the more generalized overhead that many firms are now starting to cope with. While Amazon is more dependent on robots and automation, they still greatly depend on low to mid skill level employees at their warehouses to keep things going. Wages are increasing, so that may hit the bottom line. Turns out didn't hit their bottom line quite as much as people thought it was going to. And fuel costs are going up relative to the last couple of years of easing pressure at the pump. Shares for Amazon have already been really volatile well before any of these earnings whispers. Comments about the Postal Service being the delivery boy for the company, and I quote that, shot the stock down double digits just weeks ago. Compounded with a certain sense of that international pressure with Walmart's rumored high bid for Flipkart, India's e-commerce leader, many fear Amazon, while immensely successful in terms of revenue thus far, will be stretched too thin in markets that are well established for the retailer. And one last note before we get into the results, which as I've already alluded to, the results are pretty good for Amazon as a company, maybe not their retail division. And we'll talk about that in a second. Although sales going up in the retail division, margins are slimmer. Whole Foods' inclusion into their fourth quarter results did manage to give us a slight glimpse into how the grocer is performing, since a fairly wide array of these announced price cuts and operational cost cutting at the company. Now, Whole Foods seemed to have not done too well revenue-wise on a comp basis, especially last quarter, but then again, their stores may end up more of a prime hub than an organic grocery pure play, making Amazon perhaps indifferent on probability that it becomes a loss leader. Now, Layton has the results, and again, this is an earnings call we've been trying to listen to even as we're recording the podcast. Shares have immediately jumped in post-earnings trading 5%, and this jump is in response to what's seen as some pretty good news for Amazon.
Yeah, this is actually in addition to about 4 or 5% they had just before closing. And then, like you said, in after-hours trading, another bump, 5 to 6%. This jump being compounded with the after-hours trading jump propelled the company's stock to all-time highs yet again to at one point over $1,612 a share in aftermarket trading. If this holds through the next couple of days, Trent, it will actually end up giving the company a $760 billion market valuation. That is a massive company up there with the likes of Google and Apple. So far in the media landscape, we have seen hyperbolic headlines using phrases such as blown away, destroys expectations, crushes estimates, and smashes earnings, among others. Those were the main ones that popped up on my Google search, but revenue for the company did end up topping expectations, coming in around $51.04 billion versus the $49.78 that Trent had already said was expected from Thomson Reuters, ends up being a near 43% increase year over year versus the expected 39% increase. Both of those numbers, even if they would have hit the 39% mark, are very robust for Amazon. MarketWatch pointed out that everyone pretty much anticipated growth, but some may have been a little bit surprised in that the growth was bigger than it had been in previous years. They were expecting actually growth to taper, some analysts out there. For context, they point out that in 2017, sales grew at a pace of roughly around 31% after expanding 27% in 2016 and 20% back in 2015. So again, contrast that with the 43% they just ticked in for their first quarter earnings. You're looking at a company that is very bullish for 2018. Granted, this is still just the first quarter. Net income topped $1.6 billion, a number that represented a 120% surge since the first quarter of last year. Their profit marks were actually down this time last year. This absolute figure of $1.6 billion actually represents the most quarterly net income the company has ever reported since being either a public or a private entity. We can assume that the company never ended up making a net income when it was privately held. But so far, we see that earnings per share did offer a massive beat, and probably the biggest beat of this whole entire report. We see $3.27 per share came in for the company versus the $1.26 per share expected. AWS revenue topped $5.44 billion versus the $5.25 expected from some analysts. This according to FactSet. We note that not all investment firms actually end up breaking out Amazon Web Services, but rather give aggregate figures, taking in consideration all of their different business facets and putting it into sort of their annual prospectus. We see in a statement from Jeff Bezos, he said that AWS had the unusual advantage of having a 7-year head start before facing like-minded competition, and the team has never slowed down. He's really big in terms of trying to innovate and trying to create more value for their current customer base. He said that's why you're seeing this remarkable acceleration in AWS growth now for the two quarters in a row. They're leveraging their size and their power, Trent, here with AWS, but also what they have learned by being in the cloud computing business for so long now. As we pointed out during a recent podcast, they actually may be able to benefit in numerous ways, two distinct ways we had pointed out, in the issue of broader state taxation, if that does in fact become a thing. AWS is a more integrated platform than ever, helping an array of businesses take care of accounting duties, which may simplify doing business online for retailers that do business in a multitude of states that have different tax codes. Amazon has ostensibly been able to use their learning curve advantage as a primary advertising driver in the recent months as well, as Trent and I have both actually witnessed online commercials and a little bit of unconventional ads, but they've been more focused on their broad capabilities in AWS rather than just telling the masses that they exist in the cloud computing space. And Trent, if we break out Amazon's first quarter and operating income, it really is a function of two major businesses. Both are obvious, both we've just touched on. AWS, and now the ubiquitous North American e-commerce platform.
And between both, operating income totaled $2.55 billion. AWS, however, is still bringing in over 50%, 55% to be more precise. If one were to include international e-commerce operations, that operating profit for the retail side, that begins to not look so great, as their expansion overseas has certainly come at a cost. They posted a net negative figure for operating income internationally that topped $622 million. They may have to figure out a way to profitability here sooner rather than later. International sales beginning to encroach on North American sales, taking up roughly 48% of what the company has most recently accomplished in the U.S. and Canada. And this is perhaps our overarching issue with a lot of Amazon permeables out there. Look, Amazon is a great company as far as web services, but we're a retail podcast. And when you look at Amazon, yeah, they're taking in and cutting into a lot of segments of retail, but there's a lot of e-commerce companies that are beginning to catch up a little bit. Amazon also announced that they were raising the price of the Prime subscription today. And I don't know whether or not that's going to scare Prime consumers away. I think at this point, most people are so used to that Prime subscription that they're going to try and ride it out, just like we talk about with Costco and Sam's Club. Whenever they increase subscription amounts, it always turns out that customers stay with the company. Generally speaking, you're going to lose maybe 0.5% of subscribers by increasing the price incrementally. So I don't know that that's as big of an issue. Perhaps competition, the bigger issue. And then here's the bottom line is Amazon's retail segment really isn't all that profitable on a percentage of revenue basis. At some point, they have to be profitable. At some point, they have to make good on that over 200, now what's nearing today, over a 300 price-to-earnings ratio. At some point, they got to start making money at something other than Amazon Web Services. There's been news that they're coming out with a checking platform. There's been news they're getting into pharmacy. And what Layton said early on about them being a little bit too stretched out for their own good, that's a very real possibility as they start to get into the brick-and-mortar space. And what we're beginning to learn about Amazon is Jeff Bezos keeps talking about these forward-looking aspects when it comes to retail. And yes, some things certainly have worked out. But you look at a lot of their forays, especially into brick-and-mortar. We know that the Whole Foods sales aren't necessarily working out. Obviously, the cost-cutting is doing pretty well, but they don't break down the individual Whole Foods revenue. They trumpeted the grocery delivery from Whole Foods Market in 10 cities in the United States. You know, that's great, but we have to remember that Whole Foods, prior to the Amazon purchase, they were struggling continuing to get customers in stores as customers were looking to competitors like Natural Grocers, Sprouts Farmers Market, and then other larger companies like Albertsons and Kroger, who are starting to bring in more of an organic segment there and almost create more of a value proposition than does Whole Foods. So I'm not sure that grocery delivery in and of itself is something that's going to be unique for Whole Foods, because so many people are trying that out. So many different businesses are trying that out. Whole Foods is positioned in the marketplace as someone that's a little bit higher priced. And yeah, they mentioned that eligible Prime members can earn 5% back on Whole Foods Market purchases, but that's only when they're using the Amazon Prime Rewards Visa card. And you know what, Layton? There are a lot of rotating category credit cards that will give you 3-5% cash back on Whole Foods every day of the year without having that special Prime Rewards Visa card. So I just don't know that I'm as bullish on the retail future for Amazon. I think they'll continue to grow, but the bottom line in this business is at some point you got to be profitable. At some point you have that fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. They're growing profitability right now through AWS, but what's their ticket to higher profitability in the retail sector?
I think that really speaks to the comments we made earlier about maybe their lack of focus because they are growing so much in the recent past, especially internationally. So they're going to be taking on different cultures, different services abroad. And I think that really may have them stray away from the retail side here domestically. But as for now, I'm mulling through the highlights from their recent earnings call, and you see that they have over a page and a half of highlights, whereas most publicly traded companies, when they have an earnings report, they just maybe have 3 or 4 bullet points, whereas Amazon here, I'm counting around 30. But you're seeing a theme here, and an important theme that I need to relate to our listeners, and that it's not just about retail. They want to create an ecosystem to where within that Prime platform, they want everybody to go to Amazon.com to not only enjoy the retailing aspects of the company, but also Prime Video and Prime Music, both of which I have and have actually enjoyed compared to other similar platforms. However, I will say that very little of these highlights are actually focused on the retail side. They do, however, talk about different polls that have been taken over the last year or so, talking about how they're number one as far as the reputation they have in customer service. And this is the case. I think the talk about Jeff Bezos's customer obsession really comes into play here if you read through these highlights. But you're talking also about different highlights that are really focused on something like the home security company Ring that was bought recently and the other Alexa-specific items that they're talking about as far as new features are concerned. So overall, very impressive for this company. We don't want to take away what they had just accomplished in this latest quarter at all. Their high profitability marks for AWS, extremely impressive. And their deep learning algorithms, everything they've really been coming out with that help in the virtual space, have to be highlighted here. But overall, Trent, I think you do have a point in saying that, you know what, retail, if this is the company's backbone, they really need to emphasize that going forward in 2018 and beyond, because you cannot forget about those core customers that just want products and just want the vast array of products that they've been offered in the past as far as the selection and the price point. So maybe by funneling energy and capital towards these other projects, you'll take away from that a little bit and give your competitors an advantage to really get a one up on you, especially those niche retailers like Wayfair.com or even Kohl's, which has obviously partnered with Amazon in the past and still continues to partner with Amazon, but selling things like fashion, electronics, those type of niche categories where companies that have been doing it for quite some time in the brick and mortar space, they may be able to offer a differentiated experience by the technical expertise behind some of those items.
We close out today's show with a segment of retail we don't visit very often, and that's rent-to-own, as Aaron's released their first quarter earnings before the bell on Thursday. As we've discussed in the distant past, these companies are unique, the rent-to-own companies, that is, in that they often see their greatest success when the economy isn't doing so great. In fact, Aaron's themselves, they're a negative beta stock on the stock market at negative 0.57. Basically, a negative beta stock means that they go up typically when the rest of the economy does not. As a retailer, they tend to see sales going up, especially during times of economic hardship. Customers are more willing to buy a product on a week-to-week or month-to-month payment plan because they don't have the capital needed to purchase big-ticket items. But in this economic climate, and as we've seen from the likes of Best Buy, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Amazon, who we've just talked about, among others, households increasingly have additional income to spend. This generally means that people are overlooking retailers like Aaron's, who have a higher overall purchase price on items in exchange for the ability to finance products at a high premium. Because when you do buy in the rent-to-own sector, you're buying at a premium of anywhere between 30 and sometimes up to 50% on products. So let's get down to this earnings call. Lighten the headwinds working against Aaron's. Well, they showed themselves during this earnings call, which took place on Thursday.
For this story that we've actually been looking towards for quite some time, because we don't cover Aaron's a whole lot on this podcast, as Trent talked about, I actually visited a local Aaron's. And Trent, those prices, you're dead on here. You would be paying a premium either if you financed these items or bought them outright. Over 20% some of these items. I was doing comps in real time on my smartphone. It's just astonishing the markup they're able to charge some of these customers that come in to their individual locations. But as far as the earnings call is concerned, the headwinds working against Aaron's showcased themselves during their earnings call on Thursday again. Likewise, the stock took a beating and was quickly down another 11% in the morning trading after the call. It wasn't all bad for the company, as we'll discuss later. However, the big news was in the miss on the earnings part of it. Zacks consensus estimates had earnings coming in around 95 cents per share. As it turned out, Aaron's came in with 73 cents per share, or 81 cents on a non-GAAP basis. These numbers were roughly in line with their 2017 first quarter. Revenue, as expected, did grow for the company overall. Total revenues topped out just over $950 million, up 13% since last year. However, this was driven primarily by an increase in revenues at the Progressive Leasing division. That division saw revenues up 33% on invoice growth of 31%. This at a time when Aaron's revenue decreased year over year by 2.4%. Although they missed on earnings, their CEO, John Robinson, was actually fairly positive on the call, noting that the increase in top-line revenue will help them to reach profitability goals in future quarters. He said that the increased expenditures that caused the bottom-line miss were due to capital investments to strengthen the company's long-term position. Always something we like to hear anytime a struggling company is talking about reinvestment rather than issuing, let's say, a one-time dividend. That is going to fare well for the company. So, what is Progressive Leasing and why has it been doing so well for the company? Progressive Leasing, they refer to it as a virtual lease-to-own company. However, rather than being an e-commerce-driven business, as the name virtual might suggest, they have partnerships with over 27,000 retail locations in 46 states that provide similar services to what Aaron's provides. So more of a service provider, and they bought them here recently, and we could see the fruits of that acquisition already paying off.
Yeah, basically, this company provides a lease-to-own safety net when consumers are turned down based on credit for store-generated primary financing options. So when they don't get a credit approval, trying for credit through that store in and of itself. So it makes sense for retailers to forge a partnership. It's kind of a safety net for that consumer. It keeps that consumer's money coming in, and they don't have to turn as many customers away based on financing needs. So it makes sense for a retailer to partner with someone like Progressive Leasing. And there's retailer flexibility with this partnership in that different retailers can set up different sets of financing criteria for its customers. Some have more constraints like needing social security numbers, while others just have employment verification and a minimum age requirement. The growth here for Progressive Leasing spurred largely from a growth in retail partnerships. Examples of some of the partnerships they've formed come by way of Big Lots, Gallery Furniture, and Mattress Firm. We mentioned they have 27,000 stores they partner with now. At the same time last year, after the first quarter last year, that number was 22,000. This has helped them increase their number of customers on March 31st of 2018 versus March 31st of 2017 by 20%. It's up to 724,000 current customers. So these are customers taking advantage of the financing options, not the individual stores. Because this is leased to own, having this many customers, that means revenue will continue to trickle in from these customers over the next two quarters, as many of them are on contracts to pay back for the furniture. In addition to increasing their client base nearly 23% in the last year, they've increased their number of partner stores by 10,000 since the first quarter of 2016. This is exponential growth from a side of their business that is no longer small potatoes when compared to their traditional Aaron's stores. In fact, during this time of rapid expansion for Progressive Leasing, Aaron's has dropped from over 2,000 company and franchisee operated stores to now 1,719 total stores. So Aaron's is dropping in terms of number of stores. Meanwhile, Progressive Leasing increasing the number of stores total nationwide that they partner with. And Progressive Leasing is now such an integral part of their business, it made up over 50% of their revenue in the first quarter. Aaron's revenue came in at $458.8 million. Progressive Leasing over that for the first time at $486.5 million. So now let's talk about Aaron's. We've talked about why they might be struggling in this economic climate and why they're a major reason the company as a whole missed on profit expectations. Aaron's same-store revenues were down 4.4%. Their customer count was down 4.2%. And these are at stores open at least a year. However, they did keep their store count relatively even during the quarter. They added 10 franchised stores. Again, they're partially franchised. They refranchised two company-owned stores, and they closed a company-owned store and closed a net of four franchise stores. So overall, not a lot of movement when you consider the number of stores they have. It was an incremental increase, which is different from the closures they've seen over the last couple of years. Currently, about 31% of their store base is franchised out, and it's with the franchise stores that Aaron's division is truly struggling. We've seen franchises outperform company-owned stores in the QSR and QSR Plus industry, but it's actually Aaron's franchisees that are fighting the headwinds most here. In fact, their lease revenue and their fees for the first quarter were actually up 1.6% in company-owned stores over last year. But their merchandise sales to franchisees, and this is where Aaron's makes the money on the franchisees, is selling the merchandise to them, which they then rent to own to customers. This is classified as non-retail sales in their earnings report. When you break it down and break that out, their merchandise sales to franchisees actually went down 23.2%. Now, granted, some of this over the last year is due to repurchasing some franchise stores, but the loss of these merchandise sales was not made up in increases in lease revenue at some of the now company-owned locations, and the existing franchise stores continued to struggle a little bit. And as a result of these trends, Aaron's revised expectations for 2018, the rest of the fiscal year, downward. They're now expecting same-store sales to be negative for the full year, negative 1% to negative 4%, and even this may be optimistic and would signal actually a quarter-over-quarter turnaround later in the year in same-store sales. Now, they do still guide same-store sales to be up to flat in the fourth quarter of 2018, but it's not going to quite turn around what's been already established in a tough first quarter of 2018. So in closing here, the market unhappy with the shortcomings at the Aaron's division, resulting in an immediate dip in the stock price. Again, this earnings call took place before the bell on Thursday. The price remained depressed throughout Thursday, around $41 per share. That's an 8% decrease from the prior day's trading. They do offer a 3-cent per share dividend per quarter. Leighton mentioned they don't give much of a dividend, and they use a lot of that cash to kind of filter back in through the system to kind of self-improve. They're in the midst, though, of a $500 million share repurchase program. So this is a way in which they're returning value to the shareholders, even in this time of decreased cash flow overall for Aaron's compared to what they've seen in years past. They continued to mention on the call during the analyst Q&A continued strategic initiatives as they struggle in Aaron's sales, and these include potential closures. They also mentioned acquisitions, and there's probably more of the former needed if you're looking at it this way, but they did mention acquisitions if they can get a hold of an independent store or even a franchise store in an area where they feel like they can turn it around, they will take advantage of that. But basically, our takeaway is that as long as people have access to 0% interest credit cards, you know, where you get 0% for 12 months or 0% APR for 18 months or 24 months in some cases, or if customers have other methods of cheap or reduced financing or liquid cash to make large purchases, Aaron's is going to continue to struggle as other large item retailers do enjoy some success. And you might say, well, that makes it sound like Progressive Leasing might also struggle. We keep in mind that Progressive Leasing's growth is largely based around the additional businesses they have in their cash. When you compare their additional businesses to their overall sales on a per business basis, that's been fairly stagnant and in some cases has fallen. So again, it's a tough climate. Aaron's is doing their best. We really like what they're doing with the Progressive Leasing division and partnering with other businesses. They saw value in that acquisition and they took it. But now they've got to figure out a way to make Aaron's stores function in this robust economic climate. And it's interesting to say that because oftentimes we talk about the robust economic climate helping out retailers. This is one case where the robust economic climate right now and having a lot of expendable income per household compared to where we were 5-10 years ago is actually hurting Aaron's as a whole.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final stage of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story we're keeping our eye on for the next week or the next month, and we begin with Leighton.
My Looking Ahead story is actually going to be a 2-in-1 as I look forward to Chipotle for 2018 and Subway, as they both reported different sets of news this week. Chipotle came out with their first quarter earnings, and they ended up beating on net income and had a fairly solid rise in revenue, with same-store sales also beating analyst estimates, coming in around 2.2%. But my Looking Ahead has to do with their CEO, Brian Niccol, which is relatively new to the company. He came from Taco Bell, which, of course, is owned wholly by Yum Brands. He's actually looking towards creating maybe new menu options and extending store hours for Chipotle for 2018. So I'm curious to see if they can carry this momentum, as if you look at the share price as of today, it looks as though the company is actually seeing their biggest increase since they've been a publicly traded company. And overall, you see that all of these changes, it really has to do with the long pronounced turnaround that Chipotle is undergoing ever since the E. coli incident a couple of years ago. With Subway, they came out with news this week. Even though they aren't publicly traded, they have been having some sales woes. And a report came out that they're looking to close maybe 500 locations throughout the United States and either revamp or relocate 1,000 others. And this is on top of the news that we had reported in our older podcast, the Food Focus podcast, and that they're trying to revamp their brand, really trying to refresh how they're perceived by the public. And with that, they have some new interesting limited time items that you may have seen in those conventional ad campaigns that they've been rolling out. But in general, you're looking at a very mature company in Subway that has thousands of locations throughout the United States, thousands more internationally, and it looks as though that is where they're going to be funneling their money, is in the international landscape, as they look to open over 1,000 locations overseas. So a very interesting market, especially in North America, where you see Subway is very mature, but not in different markets such as Mexico and Canada. They're still growing there. So very interesting things to look forward to with Chipotle and Subway in the year ahead.
Well, my Looking Ahead story has to do with Tractor Supply Company. And if it's another episode, and if Amazon isn't releasing earnings today, we're probably talking about Tractor Supply Company on the show, but they kind of got lost in the shuffle. They came out with earnings today as well, and their comparable store sales increased 3.7% compared to a decrease of 2.2% last year. But that's not why I'm looking ahead. Oftentimes, when I talk about Tractor Supply Company on this show, it's because of weather. And they are one of the most weather volatile retailers out there. We talked about some of the colder weather maybe hindering Sherwin-Williams, especially as it pertains to the sales of outdoor paint. Well, looking at Tractor Supply Company and breaking down their earnings, listening to their earnings call, they actually saw significant success in winter-based categories. Part of that was because it was so cold throughout much of the U.S., and that cold weather lingered. Now, the problem with that is their spring sales were depressed a little bit. Even still, Their comps went up 3.7%. Transaction count went up 3.2%. Ticket went up 0.5%. So they actually completed more transactions. And the reason I'm looking ahead, I want to see 3 months from now where Tractor Supply is, because they're always going to have the spring sales regardless of when spring takes place. We've got a later spring this year, so the spring's been pushed into the next quarter along for Tractor Supply. And I'm anxious to see if they see another benefit from weather and if this is just a perfect weather year for Tractor Supply. Now, they have a lot of other initiatives that we've liked. We talk at length about expenditures on pets in the U.S. going up over the last several years. Their expansion of PetSense is scheduled to continue. They're looking at opening even more coming up in the next quarter. They opened up, as it is, 4 PetSense stores in the first quarter of 2018. But the main thing I'm looking at the weather and how it's going to affect Tractor Supply. We can't say that they're a bellwether for certain other companies, but there are a lot of privately held companies that do much the same thing as Tractor Supply does. Atwoods being one of them. We've talked about Mills Fleet Farm in the past on the podcast. They're another, as well as Big R stores. So we can kind of extrapolate what kind of effect the weather is having on those retailers from how it affects Tractor Supply. And that's the big reason I'm keeping my eye on that. Well, a big thanks for listening to this week's Retail Focus Podcast. Again, I'm Trent. He's Layton. Check us out on Twitter or Instagram at Retail Podcast. And if you have a story idea, feel free to shoot it to us, retailpodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.